Ken Forrester, Executive Director at Momenta. Welcome to our Digital Thread podcast, produced by, for, and about digital industry leaders. In this series of conversations, we capture insights from the best and brightest minds in digital industry. They're executives, entrepreneurs, advisors, and other thought leaders. What they have in common is, like our team at Momenta, they are deep industry operators. We hope you find these podcasts informative. And as always, we welcome your comments and suggestions. Good day and welcome to episode 221 of Momenta Digital Thread podcast series. Today, I'm pleased to host Sandeep Pandya, author of The ESG Revolution and the CEO of a new stealth startup. Sandeep is a purposeful and entrepreneurial C-level leader with a successful record of developing teams, products, and new markets across technologies and industries. He was most recently the CEO of Evergard.ai, an AI joint venture backed by the Boston Consulting Group Digital Ventures and SEA Global Incorporated, a global steel conglomerate. Evergard AI's mission is to make the world's industrial environment safer with machine learning and computer vision solutions, and to drive a paradigm shift in safety from reactive to proactive approaches. Now, Sandeep is a recognized thought leader and member of the Forbes Technology Council and recent author of the book, The ESG Revolution, How Worker-Centric AI is Transforming Industrial Sustainability. He earned an MBA from Northwestern University's J.L. Kellogg Graduate School of Management, and BS and MS degrees in computer science from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Sandeep, welcome to our Digital Thread podcast.
Thanks for having me, Ken. I appreciate being on.
And it's really good to have you. I appreciate you taking the time out of, I know, very busy between writing books and doing a stealth startup. So it's great we're finally having a chance to connect. So, you know, we call this the Digital Thread podcast, and we talk a lot about one's individual digital thread, like how did we get here, right? So what I'm curious, what would you consider to be your digital thread? In other words, those thematic threads that define your digital industry journey.
Yeah, thanks for the question. When I think about the arc of my career and the things that I've had a chance and privilege to be a part of, you know, I've always been a technologist for more than three decades now, starting obviously with my education as an engineer and a computer scientist. And, you know, at large pure tech companies in the wireless infrastructure space or devices or semiconductors, things like that. And so really, I was a pure technology guy for a long time. But what I would say is my digital thread more recently, almost in the last decade, is figuring out how to take, you know, advanced technology, these deep technologies, which, you know, can reference things like artificial intelligence, computer vision, sensor fusion, there's so many of these things now, and trying to bring them into foundational industries and try to transform industries that generally aren't synonymous with, you know, deep technologies or advanced technologies on a day-to-day basis. And so in the last almost 10 years, I've been able to, you know, help launch two venture-backed startups from scratch as employee three and employee one, but that were focused on bringing AI into commercial trucking, the steel and metals industry, construction, you know, mining, warehousing, things like that. So I think that's been exciting because it poses a different set of challenges we can talk about. And then the other part of the digital thread is in bringing these deep technologies into these foundational industries, also keeping in mind kind of the ESG movement, the environmental, social, and corporate governance revolution that's kind of going on and how these technologies can enable that.
You know, in a way, you've just described basically Momenta and Momenta's investment thesis in
awesome.
Both of them. And I love the way you talked about foundational industries. And we certainly firmly believe ESG represents really the outcomes, we call it industrial impact, that we're driving toward at the end. And so this will be a great conversation. Now, I noticed in your Forbes bio, it said you believe the world is experiencing a technological renaissance, one that will fundamentally reshape and improve the way people live, work, and play globally. Tell us a little bit about this renaissance and what's creating it.
Yeah, thanks. When I actually, you know, kind of penned that particular part of the bio almost a decade ago, and a lot's obviously happened in the world since then, both technologically and then, you know, from an ESG perspective. But the reason that I think that the Renaissance is continuing is because I believe that there has been, you know, I'd say in the last couple of decades, but even more recently, even in just the last several years, a confluence of what look like apparently disparate technology disruptions, things that represent there's different definitions for technology disruptions, but something that, like Malcolm, you know, Caldwell talked about in his book, Tipping Point, that create a movement or a change that represents kind of a point of no return, kind of something going viral and, you know, genie out of the bottle. And I feel that there's been a confluence of these various technology disruptions that have come together and allowed really, really hard problems, you know, problems that might have been seen as intractable, you know, maybe 50 years ago, 40 years ago, to now be tractable, to be feasible to go after. And so things like climate change, trying to make industry more efficient, but on a pan-global scale, democratizing knowledge. These are things that now people can talk about seriously because of the confluence of a whole bunch of different technologies. And we can get into what some of those are in a second.
Perhaps to put a point on this, let's talk about your most recent work with Evergard AI. So to help our audience kind of understand the company and your role there, what were some of the, you think you were the most notable solutions and wins?
Yeah. So, you know, really proud of the work that myself and the team that I helped build from scratch as employee one, you know, when I was recruited by BCG to come in and launch the company. So, you know, building a world-class team, the artificial intelligence, computer vision, kind of deep tech team that we built. It was a global team. But I'd say what was interesting about the team is you don't find a lot of folks, Ken, and probably you know this better than most folks, you know, that work with heavy industry and others. There are not a lot of AI computer vision folks that necessarily have worked on industrial safety and sustainability problems. And so finding talent that one is technically sharp, but also willing and interested to take on problems that aren't necessarily in their wheelhouse, that was an interesting challenge. And I'm really proud of the fact that we built a team that was doing that successfully. And to the point of being recognized, you know, we had one public recognition by an academic institution, the University of Texas, San Antonio's Department of Civil Engineering and Environmental Engineering, ranked Evergard's AI industrial safety system as the number one solution in the market, you know, compared to a host of other players that were in there, large and small. And so that was a proud moment for us. And it kind of validated all the work that we were doing from a pure kind of technology and benefits perspective in an academic kind of sanitized environment. That said, from a commercial perspective, because in the end, it's about diffusion of the technology, Evergard's flagship product, you know, Sentry 360, even when I was leaving, you know, had gone commercial and we had like a multi-digit backlog. So, you know, in terms of millions. So it was nice to see that commercially it was being very successful. And, you know, we had taken on customers like U.S. Steel and Nucor and Gerdau and other major players, you know, in the metals industry, you know, Zuckelmann Industries and so forth. But we were also now getting into construction tech and mining and some of these other industries, warehousing that I mentioned. So just overall, really, really proud of what we accomplished in nearly 4 years under my leadership. And I wish the team well. And now I'm kind of, you know, taking some of those learnings and applying them in different places.
And we'll certainly get to that in a few minutes. Whatever could have compelled you to leave a rocket ship like that must be really, really interesting. So before we get to that, though, I'd like to go a little deeper on your book. So you recently authored The ESG Revolution, again, How Worker-Centric AI is Transforming Industrial Stability. Or sustainability, excuse me. So tell us a little bit, what does worker-centric AI mean to you and why is this topic so relevant today?
Yeah, you know, the term itself, and when we were at Evergard, we actually trademarked it because it was interesting. No one had a mark like that out there. It was less about owning the mark, but more about just the psychology of how I think the world and the media tend to look at AI, you know, artificial intelligence. So you could argue that the term software has been replaced by the term AI, right? Like, I don't think people talk about software anymore. It's just all assumed to be transformed and written now in a way that is in line with best practices of artificial intelligence and machine learning. But the thing that I guess made me think about it is when people talk about AI, they talk about it as almost kind of a standalone, sanitized technology enabler, right? And the way I've always thought about technology throughout my career, whether I was in the wireless industry or whatever, is how it has a transformational impact on society. And so if AI is going to be meaningful, it has to add social value. And if it doesn't, I would argue that that particular aspect of AI is irrelevant. And so worker-centric AI, to me, felt like, okay, AI is not necessarily at odds with workers and humanity. I mean, it can be, but I wanted to take a more generative approach to it and look at it as how can AI be transformational and helpful to workers, particularly industrial workers, which you and I know tend to face different set of challenges in their environments, and then those in those industrial companies have their own challenges in the community themselves. And so worker-centric AI is really about trying to focus on the utility and benefits of AI to develop kind of an envelope, an AI envelope around the industrial worker in particular, both in personal terms, their wellness, how they're dressed for work, things like that, their workspace. So their interaction between worker and machine in these environments, right? That, what can AI do to improve that? Their work environment. So all of these folks work sometimes in very harsh environments. So air, noise, light, pollution, you know, monitoring them in their environment when there's the movement of goods and vehicles and other machinery. You know, how do you keep an eye on the environment? And so it's almost making the inside of the factory floor sustainable so that the company can project a greater sustainability envelope outside. And then the last one is corporate governance. So the worker-centric AI framework really, you know, goes from personal terms, workspace, work environment, but at the highest level, right? At the now in the ESG world, as you know, boards of directors are pressuring C-suites to be socially conscious, ESG conscious. Well, that can only really happen if they're working from good information. So at the corporate governance layer for compliance reporting, site level analytics, the organization level analytics, you need to provide what's going on with the workers and their environments up to the board level. And so I coined the term worker-centric AI to look at that full stack, that ESG stack. And Evergard's mission was to deliver on that. And, you know, that's something that I'm doing now with my new company as well.
The was an article recently about responsible AI, or RAI as they're acronyming it now. And it was actually promoted by somebody at Rockwell we have a lot of respect for. And so it's interesting to see, you use the term generative in your discussion a moment ago, which I'm sure was intentional. But now that, you know, there's been all of this hype around Gen AI, ChatGPT, and of course, you know, all of the fun over the last couple of weekends about OpenAI, there is now seems to be a second wave, or at least some may argue a third wave of voices talking about, but are we moving too fast? Are we doing the right things? Are we doing this for the outcomes that we're hoping to seek? So it's a very timely topic, you know, and I'm sure as you wrote it, you probably foresaw that. I certainly didn't.
Yeah.
In terms of the generative AI. So
sure. No, no, you're exactly right. And it comes back to the intentionality of the organization. With all the drama of OpenAI and the news and so forth, at its core level, there seemed, and again, I'm not an insider. I don't, it's all I know is what I read and hear. But I think it speaks to the ESG movement. We've talked about this before and we're like-minded in ways. It comes down to the intentionality of the organization, you know, and what they think their company brand stands for, what their mission is as a team. Because you and I both know that technology can be used in differing ways. Yeah. And if you have a well-intentioned team, you know, with a clear mission, and with kind of like the UN SDG goals or the Industry 5.0 goals in mind, then you can do good things, just like a team that doesn't have good intentions can do, you know, the wrong things. So I think in the end, it'll come down to the people. It always comes down to the people running the organization.
Yeah, no, well said in there. It's interesting. And in your book jacket, I saw you mentioned that for decades, business leaders were taught they must choose really one of two paths, protect the environment or protect shareholders. I'm curious, what do you see that has changed to enable effectively achieving both goals now?
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting. It reminds me, you know, also of a book that I read as I was on this journey over the last decade. But John Doerr, you know, the renowned venture capitalist, he wrote Speed and Scale, a book that I thought was really outstanding because it starts with the assumption that business leaders, government leaders, you know, what have you, people in society, generally are well-intentioned and, you know, they care about things like the climate and they care about a lot of these other things that we all say are the right things to do. They just lack a plan, you know, a clear plan, one that is actionable with metrics and measurements and things that you can do that are kind of within arm's reach and creating kind of a roadmap. And it kind of made me think as I was launching Evergard and now the next thing, yeah, that's kind of right. And so that made me want to write this book, The ESG Revolution. I think one of the things that previously kind of held folks back is yes, they were well-intentioned. Yes, they're running a large operation globally. Profits are important. But this other stuff is too costly or too disruptive to do. So, you know, we can't do the right thing now. We'll have to do it later when the cost comes down. Well, I think the thing that's happened, right, the thing that's causing the renaissance and the enablement of well-meaning companies now to do the right thing is I think the cost curve has really dropped on these enabling technologies. So just a simple example, right? So if you look at clean energy, right? The cost of solar panels has come down almost 90%. you know, over the last several years. You know, that now says that, okay, what is your reason now for not using, you know, for instance, wind and solar as an offset to coal or other fossil fuels? Because now you can actually deploy it. So it's just a matter of willpower. There are other things in there as well. You know, the technological disruptions that I mentioned earlier, the end of Moore's Law, for those folks that may or may not know, in the world of semiconductors, Moore's Law basically says that, you know, you can have the number of transistors on an integrated circuit, you know, on a chip double every 2 years. Well, with advanced kind of wafer technologies, you're now getting down to transistor densities that were never conceived of before. What does that mean? Well, it allows you now to run both hardware and software on problems that were considered, just as I mentioned earlier, just infeasible. And so you can now start to analyze your own organization and other things in ways that you just couldn't before. And software ultimately is the most flexible enabler there ever is, right? People like to say that software is eating the world. So I think, you know, to put a fine point on it, the cost curves have come down on ESG-related technologies, and the ability to solve a lot of problems with software inside of the enterprise or in and around the enterprise to monitor ultimately a newer set of metrics, what we call total, I'll call societal impact and metrics, as opposed to total shareholder return metrics, TSR versus TSI. If you're looking at your organization and scorecarding it more holistically, where you're looking at how human-centric you are, how climate-centric you are, in addition to how profit-centric you are, right? The triple bottom line, as we talked, you now have both the cost points and the enabling technologies and software to actually accomplish those things. And again, if you have a well-intentioned management team and board and shareholder community, I think those organizations now can actually move on these things.
So, you know, we are proponents of the EU Commission's Industry 5 initiative with its three key focus areas: sustainability, resilience, human centricity. Those words should warm your heart. Exactly. I'm going to throw you a bit of a curveball, though.
Sure.
Do you see this new triple bottom line as an evolution of Industry 4.0 or a revolution in and of itself?
Yeah. You know, so I think people like to think of things as revolutionary, but for folks like you and me that have been around industry long enough, generally, especially heavy industry, evolutionary is probably more palatable because it's the scale of change. And these are running operations, right? Whether it's a running factory or even a 30-minute disruption could impact revenue and cost someone's job, you know, that kind of thing, or shut a plant down upstream, et cetera. Generally, if you want to go to foundational industries, as I have, you know, the last several years, you have to approach from kind of an evolutionary perspective. Now, that's a personal point of view, but if you actually say with respect to the Industry 5.0 initiative, you know, I had a chance to go back and look at the EU's January 2021 report, you know, when they came out with the 5.0 thesis, it describes it, I would say, in evolutionary terms, or instead of evolution or revolution, it's really an expansion. So if we think about Industry 4.0, right, Ken, it was really more of a techno-economic enabler in the form of digitization of industry, right? So what is 5.0? How is it different? Well, it's not so much that it's an evolution of the techno-economic piece. It's more of an expansion of the socio-ecological or environmental kind of, you know, points of view, adding that into the basket of goods that represents the way Industry 4.0 and 5.0 are kind of driving industry as a whole. So, and I think it's consistent with the UN Sustainability Development Goals, again, you know, with the focus on human-centric approaches to people around the world, the environment, et cetera, you know, the 17 goals they have. So I would call it an expansion or an evolution, not necessarily a revolution, because revolutions generally don't play well in foundational industries.
Well said, and especially because I just watched the movie Napoleon over the weekend. So,
yeah, there
and
you
it
go,
starts
yeah.
off, of course, in a revolution, right? Which didn't end well, at least for some people.
Exactly.
But yours is a politically correct but very accurate answer, and I appreciate that. You mentioned earlier, you used the words a confluence,
yeah.
And in some sense, it is a confluence of, I think, Industry 4 and ESG. And to me, yep. What the EU Commission has done well is they put them together so that they don't feel like separate initiatives, or to your point in your book jacket earlier, you know, alternative paths that you can go, right? You can do the same, right? You can have it and that, right? And so in my mind, Sean O'Regan's one of the leaders of this at the EU Commission, and he purposely on every slide puts in the corner of it, say, it's an evolution, not a revolution. And part of it is he gets a lot of feedback from his German constituents, right? And I do for my US ones as well about, yay, we haven't even got to Industry 4 yet. But I think there is a bit of a revolutionary thinking in the sense that this is already taking it one step more, right? Productivity plus people plus planet is the way that I like to think about it. So good answer though. So, you know, in the book, you specifically call out the enabling effect of prescriptive analytics. Can you describe this effect and share an example of how you've seen this playing out?
Yeah. And I think this is, again, part of what I think technology now allows folks to do that they wish they could have done, you know, 20, 30, 50 years ago. It's really about using the utility and the benefits of artificial intelligence. For example, it could be other technologies too, but, you know, let's call them deep technologies, advanced technologies, to essentially be proactive in and around what we care about the most in these workplaces, which is, you know, the workers and how they interact with the environment. You know, obviously you want them to be productive, but it's also about taking care of them and making sure that the company itself does everything sustainably, as we talked about, the ESG adder onto the 4.0, you know, backbone. So really it's about being proactive. So being prescriptive, it first starts with being predictive. So the power of AI, for instance, and digitizing the organization, manufacturing, what have you, allows you to account for what is natural when you have humans in the loop, right, which are blind spots. So you can get things like inattention blindness or change blindness. You just didn't see the differences. Cognitive dissonance, as we know, right, which is you can like eating hamburgers, but you also know that the effect of eating meat, the climate, has a negative effect. So cognitive dissonance, and then any other phenomena that kind of prevents humans from seeing what we'll call an objective truth regarding, for instance, safety and sustainability or danger in the workplace. And so with the power of AI, for instance, and big data analytics at the edge or, you know, up in the cloud, wherever at the enterprise level, you can start to look for what I would call triggers are or trace elements are that ultimately lead to something bad happening. And it goes from being predictive, which is, hey, something bad's going to happen, to prescriptive if you can actually intervene. And I'll give you a simple example and I can give you a second one if you want. But in the world of, you know, let's say industrial worker safety, right, one of the number one causes injury, right, on the job is heat stress, right? And, you know, these harsh environments, whether you're working on a construction site out in the desert or even just in Southern California in the summertime, or you're inside of a coal mine, or you're working, you know, near the blast furnace of a steel mill, you can have temperature gauge inside the suit of 130, 140 degrees, right? So heat stress is an issue. Like, so, okay, obviously that's a bad thing, you know, but it can lead to dehydration. And then dehydration, a lot of times we're dehydrated, we don't even know it, that can lead to fatigue. And what happens when people are tired? Well, when people are tired, their body posture is generally poor. It's not optimal, right? So if you're lifting something, for instance, you know, that can be an issue and you tend to get sloppy. Well, then that leads to musculoskeletal disorders. And one of the number one causes of workman comp claims and lost days of productivity on the job are back injuries. So the reason that, you know, the construction site has trades that aren't on the job or someone, you know, that operates the blast furnace, you know, because they had some kind of back injury, it was really related to detecting heat stress ahead of time and intervening and telling the gentleman or lady, hey, you need to hydrate or you need to take a break. And so we actually deployed wearable sensors tied in with AI that would actually detect those things, including upper torso movements that were awkward. And we brought together basically core physiology plus upper torso movements to detect not only heat stress and fatigue, but ultimately cut back on back injuries and reduce lost productivity. And so all of that represents a predictive and prescriptive chain that makes the company ultimately, you know, more efficient and the workers happier and healthier.
Okay, I can't wait anymore at this point. I got to jump to the big question. So you've got to tell us about this stealth startup that you've started. What are you working on and what do you expect to, when do you expect to come out of stealth?
Yeah, so thanks for that. And it picks up on the theme that you mentioned earlier, you know, the generative AI, I'll call it a tipping point that's been crossed with OpenAI and other companies jumping in and putting so many resources on it. It really is, I think, a meaningful tipping point. You know, OpenAI was the fastest product introduction in the history of products, you know, with 100 million monthly users being added in just 2 months, and it's just grown since, and now there's so many alternatives as well. So that inflection point really got me to think about, hey, how can I continue to take this theme about, you know, worker-centric AI and leverage the generative AI movement, particularly the large language model movement that is there that we see, which, you know, kids are using to help do their homework, but doctors are using to help do research and other things. There's so many applications. But without giving too much away, because we're in stealth mode, is we looked at not industrial workers on the factory line, but something upstream, which is really not how products get made, but how are products designed, right? The engineers, the designers who, and particularly, I'll call them highly technical industries. So whether it's civil engineering, environmental engineering, aerospace, medical devices, a lot of these engineers and designers are bound by compliance requirements, regulations, you know, building codes, things like that. And it just seemed like a natural fit to take advantage of the power of generative AI, particularly large language models, and apply them to the world of design engineering, you know, for products. And you say, well, okay, but what's the social value add? Well, when you look at the cost, for instance, engineering change orders because a compliance requirement was missed way upstream when the building was being designed or the plane was being designed or the medical device was being designed, if you can nip it in the bud there, if you can catch it right there using the power of generative AI, then the downstream impact, right, is far lower and it may be completely mitigated. And so I founded a company with a co-founder this summer after leaving Evergarde. We're coming out of stealth mode probably in Q1. The alpha is built and we're ready to go to market probably, you know, in a couple of weeks here. But it's really exciting. And again, it's with the theme of using AI to help workers do their job better and overall create some social value.
Well, I have to question your timing. So let's see, between Industry 5, all of the hype around AI right now and interest in that, I don't know that you could have found a better timing to be developing this and to be coming out of stealth. Let's all fingers crossed that the headwinds that, you know, we've had in the economy will evaporate, as many VCs think they will, in Q1, Q2 of next year. So you might actually be going into both a good valuation season, but also at least some exit potential there. And by the way, did I mention Momenta actually does venture capital investment in companies like that? I don't remember if we talked about that or not, but yeah.
No, we haven't, but I follow that and I would definitely love to bring this to you at the right time.
Baby. Good. I look forward to that conversation. So in closing, we always like to ask, where do you find your personal inspiration?
Yeah, I think people represent the most interesting elements throughout history. And what I look at are not just original thinkers, but what I like to refer to as fearless thinkers, the folks that not only had an original thought or concept, but let's say the courage of their convictions to affect change. And you can look across, not just in technology, but across the arc of human history, and you see civil rights leaders, environmental leaders, you know, so Gandhi, Martin Luther King, but, you know, Rachel Carson, who wrote Silent Spring about the damage of pesticides and was really one of the progenitors of the environmental movement. You see these people, and by the way, she was just lambasted by the chemical industry, as you can imagine, when she came out against, you know, kind of pesticides and biocides. So I am always impressed by folks that not only have an original thought and want to see some change, but are up against a mountain of resistance. And to some degree, I think, Ken, maybe you and I would agree that when it comes to the ESG movement, sustainability, the folks that are fighting the climate battle, but also within industry and technology, you know, a lot of days it feels like there's more resistance than momentum. And so, you know, with firms like yours and your VC fund and the thoughtful leaders that you work with, I'm hoping that, you know, there are more and more fearless thinkers that are, you know, willing to go out there and affect change for the benefit of society.
Well, I'm honored that you referenced us among that list of forward thinkers or fearless leaders and fearless thinkers, as you say. So thank you for that very much. So Sandeep, thank you for sharing this time and these insights with us today.
Of course, it was a pleasure.
Believe me, it was my pleasure, and I know it'll be the audience's pleasure in listening to this when it publishes. So this has been Sandeep Pandia, author of The ESG Revolution and CEO of a new hot Gen AI stealth startup. Thank you for listening, and please join us for the next episode of our Digital Thread podcast series. We wish you a momentous day. You've been listening to the Momenta Digital Thread podcast series. We hope you've enjoyed the discussion, and as always, we welcome your comments and suggestions. Please check our website at momenta.one for archived versions of podcasts, as well as resources to help with your digital industry journey. Thank you for listening.